I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to Spark My Muse, everyone. This is a really special episode with someone who has greatly inspired me as a broadcaster, and I am so delighted to welcome Krista Tippett today to the program. Krista Tippett is a Peabody Award-winning broadcaster, a New York Times bestselling author, and in 2014, she received the National Humanities Medal at the White House for, quote, thoughtfully delving into the mysteries of the human existence, unquote. She is the host of the public radio program and podcast On Being. And today we're also going to be talking about her book, Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. What I love about your show is how you ask people what their spiritual and religious childhood was like and how that formed them. And my graduate school background is spiritual formation. That's always a question that's always intrigued me. How do these people come to be the way they are? What's made them who they are? And your book, Becoming Wise, really delves into more of your personal background, which I really enjoyed reading in more depth. But I was really curious to see what might your children say about their own background, because you've been so influenced by so many wise voices, and you've had a really diverse spiritual amalgamation of all these different voices in your own life.
Yeah. And you know, to be honest, somebody said to me, I think it was Sylvia Boorstein, said, you know, our children are rarely listening to what we say. I mean, that they're more than they're listening to what we say, they're watching what we do, which is discouraging because we feel like we have so many things to impart to them. And of course, I'm such a word person. So I just say that because it's true that I don't know how influenced my kids were by all these spiritual conversations I was having. I definitely would come home and talk to them about it, you know, say, oh, I interviewed the most interesting person today, or they'd be aware of me getting ready for something. Sometimes I'd play them something. But the truth is they probably internalized more how all of that was affecting me, right? You know, that I was renewed or excited. I know my daughter said to me once that she'd learned from me, I don't know how she said it, to not see people with distinctions, to be welcoming and to just not see difference in a way. And I thought that was really wonderful, but I honestly don't remember ever saying anything like that to her. So somehow I think it's true, like somehow, and maybe that was connected to my conversation. I mean, my kids, it would be really interesting to ask them this question because they have a father who's an Episcopal priest. And then I was doing this public radio show. Now, we divorced when my son was 6 and his sister was 10. And I was in, you know, so church was always with their dad, and that's how they wanted it. And that's how I wanted it. It meant that they really didn't want me to be, they didn't want to have a second church where they were going with me. Which was interesting. So I did not have the pressure that a lot of people have, you know, it's like, what am I giving my children? Because, you know, with their father, it was there. And I think I remember my daughter, saying at some point when she was 16 or something, I don't believe in God, or I believe in Jesus, but I don't believe in God. And her brother, who's more of a kind of conservative type person, he kind of slapped his hand down on the table. You know, he's younger. He said, your father is a priest. Your mother has a radio show about religion and you don't believe in God. And I said, well, Sebastian, I think that's exactly the point here. But of course he didn't, the irony was lost on him at 10 or whatever it was. So it would be, I think they soaked up a lot. But I also think the answer to that question changes across the lifespan. So what they might say at 18 and 22 would probably be really different at, you know, 3842. And I hope I'll be around to hear what it might be.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and we don't know what they're catching from us as we evolve spiritually. Yeah, it's fascinating. I think that too. And similarly to you, I came from a really, really conservative fundamentalist Baptist upbringing. And so then the evolution is really, if you're going to evolve, it's going to be really stark, right?
Yeah.
And so you wonder what they're catching, if they're catching the revolt from that, or the pushback from that, or if they're catching something completely new altogether.
Yeah, and I actually think they inherited from me a very kind of nostalgic, loving view of their grandfather, who really was a kind of hellfire and brimstone preacher, and much of the theology that I experienced, or, you know, not all of it, but much of it, it just could not be more different from where I've ended up. But there are things that that I regret that I didn't pass on to my children. I mean, I think the world has changed, like just the hymn singing that was my childhood. And they don't get that in the same way as Episcopalians. Mm-hmm. So some of that I would kind of play these old hymns around the house, and they just got snippets of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so when they were with you, they wouldn't really attend a church, but what did you do for your own spiritual practices or your own community, and what have you done in more recent times as far as practice or spiritual practice?
Yeah, oh, for me, I currently don't have a church, and I suspect I will again, but I think partly because the kids really didn't want to have any kind of divided identity. Mm-hmm. I just let it be true that I work really hard, and Sunday mornings were contemplative time, but not a time that I was getting up and going out. And also I travel a great deal, so I wasn't always home on weekends. So my contemplative, it's more that I have a meditative contemplative practice that's private. And that also has changed over the years. You know, there was a time when I read the Compline service in the Book of Common Prayer every night. Right now I'm reading kind of between Pema Chodron and Thomas Merton. I have kind of a morning time of quiet, but and now that my kids are not at home, there's more of that. I interviewed Karen Armstrong many years ago, and she said, she became kind of a great scholar of religion in the modern world. And she said, my work is my prayer. Mm. And I think there's something, I think that does kind of reflect a way that I have treated my work across the years. But actually recently I realized that as much as that is true, it's not enough. And that I actually really do need to have a practice, not just of meditation, but of prayer. So I've been deepening that lately.
Hmm. And the kind of prayer that is spoken or apophatic, because you were talking about contemplative, but do you mean spoken prayer?
Yeah. I haven't talked to anybody about this. I took a couple of, I took a great vacation at the end of the summer, but I also was on, went to a retreat center as part of that. And I actually wrote a prayer, which I've never done before, that I've been kind of saying every morning. Mm. And it has some traditional elements in it, but it also just speaks to like where I am in my life right now. And then I do reading. So it's a combination of reading of this very bare bones liturgy, and then gratitude. And, you know, I really, much less than when I was growing up, or much less than my grandfather, I don't even know what I mean when I say that I pray. Mm-hmm. I have all these questions about who God is and what God is. And, but I sort of realized recently that first of all, I get to keep having those questions, but there is something essential and grounding about having this as part of my life. Mm. And I always say that I have such a take a delight in mystery, and it's grown more spacious for me, and I don't have a need to tie up all the loose ends.
Yeah.
So I need to let that be true of my prayer life as well.
Yeah, and I was thinking about sort of the theology of prayer, if you will, that the why does anyone pray? Why do we pray? And thinking in terms of my own journey, maybe this is true for you too, that prayer is something that we do that winds up changing us. It's not like to get God to move a lever or something like that, that we find sometimes.
Right.
We find that it's a internal thing that's happening that's changing us.
I think it's also, it's an orientation, maybe an orientation to mystery. And yeah, my prayer now has very little to do with asking for things, which was a lot of how I thought of it when I was growing up.
Yeah. In terms of theology, I don't even know if you ever even think about a practical theology in the context of what you do or how you do your work, but you bring up ideas about what it means to be human and what it means to exist in many different, from many different vantage points from your guest's point of view. Mm-hmm. And in terms of what that means in contemporary life and in common life, you have this unusual mix of, you know, journalism background and like a Master of Divinity degree, you know, one of these really weird combinations you don't ever see much, but I find it, you know, incredibly fascinating. It puts these two things together, and it goes and endeavors to answer some of these deeper questions about life and living. And how do you see that theology working out in a practical way for everyday life?
I went to divinity school in the early 90s because I had started to take religion seriously in myself and in the world. And I needed to know that that could involve the life of the mind and that it could be complex enough to meet the world in its complexity. And I just found studying theology absolutely thrilling and such a discovery. And, you know, so even as somebody who'd gone to church, not one, not two, but three times a week when I was growing up, I really hadn't been introduced to the language or the tools of theology, of really unlocking the biblical text, of this conversation across the ages about these, you know, abiding questions. And, you know, I came out of divinity school and I had been a journalist. So I still have the eyes of a journalist on the world, but I, you know, the kinds of questions that theology asks, the subjects it engages, felt, you know, they were exciting for me, and they were absolutely missing from public discussion, you know, of religion, but anything else. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I would say I very directly was bringing that mindset and those tools into then my desire to, you know, to create a media space. And, you know, I brought all my books from divinity school to my public radio office, and I thought I'm probably the only public radio host who has all these concordances, New Testament, and these different translations. And I, you know, I was really aware as I started doing the show, because the show obviously was not a Christian show. Mm-hmm. And so I was, and you know, it started in the immediate post 9/11 years. So, you know, interviewing Muslims and also understanding that tradition and the diversity within that tradition felt really urgent. Mm-hmm. And I was really aware that having studied Christian theology and Jewish theology to an extent, in the Hebrew Bible, absolutely also gave me a foundation for asking, deep and relevant questions of people from very different traditions. So, you know, that's a long way to say I think my theological education and my reverence for theology as a human discipline runs all the way through the work.
Yeah, there's a lot in, I was recently going over Ecclesiastes and some of the wisdom literature in the Bible, and, you know, a lot of people think about the Bible as, you know, the Gospels or something like that, and there's so much rich ways the Bible and scriptures of different traditions, but encounters just living in the world, and just the practical way of living in the world and living with each other. And it's time-tested. And then when we approach how other people, other traditions see it in their own time-tested ways, there's all these crossover places. And for some reason, it's not really sometimes taken very seriously in things like politics. Or maybe it is, but it's a little bit thought of as, well, those are your personal values. But in a way, everybody is operating from values.
Yeah, that's right. And unfortunately, what happens in politics and in a lot of kind of news media is that religious people and ideas get examined, they get put under a political microscope. So, but it's not seeing so many of the aspects that are distinctive to that part of life. And then I'm afraid that people who very willingly throw their theology under that political microscope are not necessarily living the fullness of the tradition, including the humility that it calls one to.
Yeah, all of the fruit of the Spirit, if you're a Christian or whatever it is for your tradition. Yeah, and that makes me I wanted to read a little piece of your book from page 168 and ask you to a little bit unpack something if I could. You talk about getting acquainted with the Book of Common Prayer, and I'll just read this little piece. It has something to do with what we just said and it might tie in well if you could expand on it. But you say here, I was living in England when I circled back to religion in my late 20s, and the Anglican Book of Common Prayer drew me with its poetry and its vigorous description of the vexing human condition. Quote, we have done those things we ought not to have done, unquote, Thomas Cranmer penned for King Henry VIII, who was as vivid an embodiment of the vexed human condition as ever walked the earth. And then there's another quote, and we have left undone those things which we ought to have done, naming the ordinary everyday failure to join inner aspiration with outer reality, a failure to take in beauty and let it put things in their place, a failure to be grateful as a habit, a failure to take the time to attend to the hurting stranger, a failure to be my best self with those I share life and work with, a failure to forgive others for not being their best selves with me. So much of what we orient toward in culture numbs a little going in and helps us avoid the reckoning we actually long for, the push to self-knowledge and deeper lived integrity. Poetry says Marie Howe, hurts a little going in. It soothes and deepens us and hurts a little all at the same time. So do many of the elements that give voice to the soul, silence and song, community and ritual, listening and compassionate presence. They wake us up, the apt Buddhist language for spiritual illumination. But there is that window of choice, moment by moment, to go for distraction instead, to settle into numb. Maybe this is another way to think about original sin, the ingrained lure of the possibility of going numb, a habit of acquiescence to it. And that is a really, there's a lot there, obviously, this pretty heady stuff.
Yeah, it is actually.
Yeah, it's pretty heady stuff. But I love what you're talking about what we ought to do and kind of being reacquainted with that in a new way through this Book of Common Prayer. And
yeah, we are such strange creatures, and it's one of the most puzzling things about human beings, that we have such intelligence and consciousness, and, you know, we have a sense of power and agency and will and choice, and it's very hard for us to sustain to make instinctive the choices that we really want to make, it takes work. I guess we're learning. We're actually learning, I think, about, just the power of some of mundane things like needing to reinforce behaviors, right? So so just the fact that something becomes a New Year's resolution isn't going to do it. that we have to do things over and over and over again. And then, we're actually learning that if we do that, we kind of create grooves in our biology and our personality. So things mm-hmm. become more instinctive, but, mm-hmm. We struggle with this. I mean, I think almost all of us really deeply want to be people of integrity, but it doesn't come naturally, and we have to cultivate it. And I think also and maybe this is the point, it sends us back to our need for each other, mm-hmm. which is also something we resist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's funny because we could say there are social pressures to do what is good because we'll be, punished or rewarded depending on what we do. But I think even if no one saw, we would still be unsatisfied with ourselves if we didn't do what we ought.
Yeah.
And so we know
we
there's...
so often don't.
Right, right. We know what we ought to do. Right. And then we don't and we feel disappointed.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And it's kind of reconciling. It's that extra consciousness or whatever's going on with that we know that we can't get away from feeling bad when we're getting it wrong.
Yeah. And I guess something that we are meant that we could honor and value is the fact that we do have this knowledge, right? Like, mm-hmm. As you said, we really do know what's right mm-hmm. most of the time, somewhere in us. Mm-hmm. And maybe just, part of this is about gaining some compassion for ourselves and mm-hmm. letting that be, letting that flow into how we resolve to just be a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. And I guess related to the part about not doing what we ought and causes suffering for other people. And so many times on your show, you've had guests that have gone through just incredible amounts of suffering and have become very wise in the process of, or after going through suffering or in the process of going through suffering. And I was curious as to your thoughts about, do you think there is like a direct connection between suffering and gaining wisdom? Do you think that it's possible to go without suffering somehow and still become wise?
Well, I think that if you live long enough in any life, there is suffering, right? There will be loss, there will be grief, there will be disappointment. I'm often astonished. I find if you scratch the surface of any life, if you're privileged enough to see below the surface, there's often, most people are walking around carrying a lot that they've lived through. Mm. So I don't think suffering is optional. Mm. And it is another irony of human existence that suffering, which we will always understandably avoid, which is never something we walk into willingly, still offers us very rich ground for emerging, in fact, in important ways, more whole and more wise. Although sometimes, sometimes it can be generations before, I'm thinking of, something that I struggled with earlier in my life is depression. And, mm-hmm. I would definitely say that in some ways, my experience of depression, I would not be who I am today. And by that, I mean, I would be a lesser person mm-hmm. if I hadn't gone through that. On the other hand, it's deepening that happened, 10 and 20 years beyond, right? So I never want to say to people in the midst of suffering, you know, this is good for you. Mm. I mean, that's right. But somehow, but we've all had this experience. You come face to face with vulnerability. You come face to face with reality in yourself, in others, in the world, that cannot help but change you. And I think we how we walk with that, what we make of it, how we work with it, you know, that's how we decide how it will change us. But I also want to say to your question, I think, yes, it's absolutely a seedbed of wisdom, but I don't think it's the only seedbed of wisdom. And I think that wisdom, one thing I had to ponder when I was writing about wisdom is I think that, you know, there's this idea of old and wise, and there is certainly something so precious and hefty about a life that has been lived long and well, and, you know, about wisdom that has emerged from long experience. Mm. But there's also wisdom that children possess, mm, right, at certain ages, that, yeah, is about the huge questions they're asking. Mm. And I think there's wisdom that people in their 20s can have, where they just have this clear eye on the world, right? Mm. And this, you know, this ability to see the world whole and to have a sense of urgency about the world's healing. Mm. And, you know, I think there's wisdom in the middle of our lives when so many of us are so loaded down with all the things we're carrying. Mm-hmm. And yet when you manage to create some calm and some balance in the midst of that, you know, that's wisdom too. So, mm, yeah.
Yeah, and as you're saying that, it makes me think there are people who can be unwise by just being closed off and impenetrable, and there's wisdom in being vulnerable in circumstances where it's risky to be vulnerable. And it brings up the next thing I was going to ask you about. If you've suffered and endured and become wiser for it, it can be, you can have gained wisdom, like, you know, practical knowledge or all different sorts of wisdom, but it can be hard to stay open to receiving more wisdom, I guess you could say, because you get, you know, afraid. And I guess from the people from your own life and the people that you've talked to throughout all these years, the wisest people who've suffered, how do they seem to stay open and continue to learn and continue to grow in wisdom?
Well, I think I would say that I experience people who are just, you know, embodied wisdom. It's just, it's, mm, something, you know, it's something you feel in their physical presence, mm, even before they've said a word. And those are people who have really faced suffering in themselves and in the world. And somehow, and this may sound paradoxical, they have, maybe because they've walked through so much and survived, mm, they find a way to stay soft. Oh. I think they find a way to be less resistant, to be more open, to be soft in the face of whatever comes, you know, whatever life will present next. Right? And so it doesn't mean they welcome it or delight in suffering. Mm. I think it does mean that they learn not to struggle with the very idea that there is hardship, or mm, that things will not go as you planned. Mm. And so in that way, in that sense, are able to kind of to lessen the suffering. Because you know, a lot, mm, of the suffering that we go through, there's a stage in so many of those moments in life where we're really suffering because we just don't want it to be happening.
Oh, yeah.
We're just struggling with the fact of it. And then there's the actual suffering itself, which, mm, which often is easier to bear than that.
Hmm. Yeah. The anticipation is maybe worse, yeah, than, mm-hmm, than it. It maybe it's like, it almost reminds me of, like, you your meat gets tenderized or something. It, right, after a pounding, and
yeah,
and then after a while you realize that you can withstand the pounding, and you're just sort of overall tenderized, and you know you can take it, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't mean that you're going to enjoy the suffering, but you're not going to, you've been through it enough times that you know you can take it.
Yeah, Brené Brown is somebody who's in the book, and she has this mm-hmm. amazing line that I actually think she's quoting somebody else, another scholar, but she says, hope is born of struggle, mm-hmm. which really doesn't make, it doesn't sound logical on the surface, and it doesn't sound logical kind of in an optimistic American mindset. Mm-hmm. But what she means is any of us can look back at the lives we've lived, and if we think about those moments that made us who we are, it almost always has a quality of us making it through something. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't know we could do. We didn't know we could survive. Mm-hmm. And you know that it's a toughness in a sense, but there's a courage that comes from that. There's a greater confidence in engaging whatever reality can throw at us.
Mm. And as I was thinking about the difference between being clever or being wise, and the difference between what makes up a wise person. I mean, obviously, you could be both clever and wise, but being truly wise, it seems like involves a deep empathy, or at least the capacity for empathy, and maybe that involves experiential service to others and developing, like I think about my children, I want them to develop wisdom and empathy from not just hearing about it, but just serving others, right? And so that's a hard thing to tell people. Well, you know, you need empathy, but you'd have to feel what someone else is feeling. And how do you feel like those pieces fit together?
Yeah, I think that it's what you're talking about is something that is embodied. Mm. I mean, cleverness or intelligence, which, as you say, can be also qualities of a wise person, mm-hmm. are kind of possessions, right? We have this knowledge. We have this wit. Mm. Wisdom is a quality of presence. And, empathy, I don't know, maybe some of us are born more naturally empathic than others, and maybe empathy is something that you can will yourself to be. Mm. What I know at the same time is that all the different kinds of sufferings and losses that we go through, if we walk through them desiring to learn from them and to grow and deepen, just one of the natural effects is that, you know, if you've been through depression or divorce or being a parent and all, you know, I mean, there's so much joy that goes along with that, and there's also just this way that the world is a place that is full of danger ever after, right, that you never saw before. Peril. You have these experiences and it changes you. You become aware that this is happening to all these other people all the time and you didn't know it.
Yeah.
And you don't forget that, right? You walk through the world just more attentive to entire aspects of human experience, which are hard. Mm. And that is, you carry that with you, right? It's in your memory, it's in your body. So that empathy, I think, just, you know, naturally arises too. Now, certainly you can choose to shut down those feelings. Mm. But I think, you know, I mean, I guess maybe what I think we could be better at is kind of accompanying each other in experiencing the fullness of that empathy and keeping it alive and deepening it. Mm. But it's there.
Yeah. I guess I think about what you're doing with your program and the space you're creating for dialogue and all the things that you've been up to is one of those wise things, bringing wisdom into the world. And the loudest voices are usually the most foolish and the most unwise, right?
Yes.
Usually
they get all the attention.
Right. They have the loudspeaker on or something. Yeah. And you see, for instance, you might see someone getting really tragically hurt and no one's helping them. They're just sort of filming it or something, right? And you're seeing a lack of empathy and you're seeing distance, maybe because of the screen or something. And I see it and I wonder, what do we do as a culture to change it? I mean, you're doing something with your program. I'm trying to do my own part in the world and in service. But what do we do? What else do we do as individuals or as neighborhoods or as communities? How do you see a place to move forward in ways that we can be more empathetic and eventually grow in wisdom?
Well, yeah, that image that you just put out there. I mean, fear is an empathy killer, right? So you can have your suffering, but if that gets compounded by you feeling like you have to batten down the hatches to not lose more, right? If you feel that your very existence is threatened, then actually, you know, parts of your brain and your body are going to override your compassion. You're going to go into a different mode, which is protect and defend and flee. And that is, that is a huge dynamic, human dynamic in American culture. Well, not just in American culture, in global culture right now. Mm-hmm. That is kind of turning our politics inside out, that is threatening the quality of the choices and decisions and policies we make. Yeah. So and also though it's tricky because depending on where you sit watching these cultural dynamics, it's hard to see what's happening as fearful. It just looks angry, and it looks dangerous, right? So, but I think that this question of what we can all do is just so important, and we get paralyzed from watching the news and getting a sense this is all so big and so bad that there's really nothing we can do. I think there's a real calling right now for each of us, wherever we live, to figure out how, you know, just this, you know, if many of us could just take up the calling to be calmers of fear, and really close to home, like where we see that and what it, and figure out what that means. I don't have a great prescription for what that means, and I think it's going to look different in any family or in any neighborhood or in any city. But I do think that this fear that is out there is really distorting, you know, what Lincoln called the better angels of our nature. And if we want, and we really need those, we really need to be leaning into the better angels of our nature to face the challenges of the 21st century together as in common life. It's not about, I mean, of course there are laws we need and policies we need, but I don't think that, I think I'm talking about work that is really about stitching a new fabric of common life, and I actually think it has to start at a very personal level for all of us. And I also, and even if I didn't believe that to be true, I think it's pretty clear that that stitching is not going to come from the top right now. So we are sent back to ourselves.
Yes, right. We're getting a lot of bad messages from I think there's the distortion is reached. Everybody knows the distortion in media is what sells and is completely manufactured at those levels, at those percentages. And so we know that the world isn't as scary as if you turn on the news. It's not like that. You just have to take a walk. You know, you just, when I was in graduate school and I was doing spiritual formation, spiritual direction, the one thing that, the one teacher was saying is, as a spiritual director, you're a non-anxious presence.
I like that. Yes. And so that's a good example.
Yeah. And I thought, a non-anxious presence, what, that sounds marvelous. I just was like, is that possible for me to be that? And but I think that it is, you're right, it is thinking that fear is an alarm bell going off, but it okay. we're much more afraid than we need to be.
Yeah, I agree.
And I don't know, well, you have to sort of band together and decide to not be afraid, perhaps, but that is what we need to be for each other.
Yes. And the other thing to keep in mind is that a non-anxious presence, that is not actually what we're trained to, that's not what we're taught in terms of how to be powerful citizens or public speakers, right? We're taught to advocate, to represent, to argue, mm-hmm. to represent our position. Mm-hmm. And we're actually empowered to get angry, to be outraged, as a moral act. And all of those things we need. But though, if those are the only postures we have to be in our common spaces, it's not good enough, right? It's not big enough. It's not complete. Mm-hmm. And so non-anxious presence. So part of what I'm saying there too is that that's not going to necessarily feel intuitive. That's really something you have to actually assert, practice, kind of try on for size, get comfortable in it. Mm-hmm. And it won't be comfortable to other people when they first experience it either. But this is really important humanizing work that we can do now.
Yeah, that's right. It's going to seem really countercultural and mm-hmm. almost apathetic, I think.
Yeah, right.
Because we're trained to mobilize people with emotion and tends to be negative emotion.
Yeah.
Or even impassioned things will seem anxious.
Yeah.
But the thing about adding calm to our surroundings and even passionate calm, but it could just still be like, I know everything's going to be okay because we're together and we're doing this together, is still going to, in a sense, be like a warm embrace instead of, sort of culturally speaking, instead of like, let's throw gasoline and light a bunch of matches, because that's what it feels like is happening, I guess, in our greater world. And maybe it's just because it's an election year. I don't know why. But I feel like we're at this fever pitch and maybe they'll calm down. But yeah, and it seems like wisdom is just kind of thrown out the window, basically.
Yeah, it will calm down. but all of this human drama that is making this election season so surprising and odd and scary is none of that human drama is going to go away. So I just think we have to start equipping ourselves to reckon with that and to be present to it.
So where do you see your own journey going in the next few years, either with On Being or with writing or your own journey in public life?
The public life piece of this has just gradually felt really important to me. The so what question, the making the connection between inner life and outer presence in the world. And I love being part of that reflection because, like you said, the other things get publicized, but so many of us are actually grappling with these things and want to be talking about them and thinking about them together. And so I actually loved being out on the book tour just to be, in rooms full of people having that discussion. And it's a very, there are many more people kind of listening, downloading a podcast, but there's still something just amazing about being in a room full of a few hundred bodies. And, you know, it's a whole different, so I want to do more of that. And, I'm trying to we moved the podcast into independent production 3 years ago, and I've been kind of the organizational leader too. And I'm realizing that I needed to do that for us to make the move, but I want to just move out of that role and focus on, you know, the the conversations and the public events and the writing. I want to do more writing, but I have a lot of arranging to do in order to make that possible. So I'm in the arranging phase right now.
Admin.
Yes, exactly. That's it.
Oh, well, I have really, really enjoyed your book. I think it's masterfully done, very enjoyable. It's a true testament to all those many remarkable lives that you've encountered over these years and all the wisdom you've gleaned along the way. I'm going to have show notes that link to the book and some other related links that to your podcast and to other things. But it is so lovely to talk to you. It's like been basically a dream come true. So I'm just so grateful to you, Krista.
It has been a joy, and I love what you're doing, and I'm honored that you're having me on, and it really delights me to hear you talk about the project and the book, and I do feel like we are comrades, so thank you for this.
Show notes for this episode can be found at sparkmymuse.com. There you'll find details for websites and people and books mentioned in this episode, and sometimes you'll find photos and videos too. Please stop by and check it out.